History of an Australian Christmas. I'm joined today by Dr. Nicholas Brown, who's a Senior Research Fellow at the School of History at ANU. Hello, Nicholas.
Good morning.
Nicholas, let's start way back in the beginning when we take a look at the first settlers in Australia, being our convicts. Did they have a very different Christmas to the soldiers?
Yes, they did. I don't think convicts got much for Christmas. There tended to be the ritual passing around of a toast of rum. That kind of thing was often the case. Relations, certainly in early convict periods, the relations between convicts and troops were fairly informal. And I think what you often see is just a desire to find familiarity, to do the sorts of things that kind of anchor people in what they take to be the real world. So Christmas is really celebrated in Australia as soon as possible. But I think the most striking thing is, and it goes back to your comment a minute ago, in ways that show a remarkable adaptation to the place. So whereas now we often have a sense of the incongruity of Christmas in Australia, you know, the winter celebration in the middle of summer, what you see right from early on is people being very adaptable to saying, well, it's not winter, so we need to make do with what we've got. In a sense, the incongruity of Christmas has become more marked over time. If we go back to that convict period, we've got records of people drinking toasts, shooting whatever they can to make the Christmas pie, a parrot pie, a black swan, if not a goose. You see that right from the start.
But the whole idea of goodwill towards man, because you were saying that both the prisoners as well as the guards were looking for moments to be the same. Did it flow through? Was there a breaking down of that barrier?
Yes, there was, and there often tended to be, certainly in the early convict period, just because there were so few ways in which people could separate themselves. I mean, those of us who kind of know the early landscape of Sydney, even if you go around the rocks, I mean, they're not places where you can get a huge amount of distance between yourself and the convict or yourself and the troops. So Christmas tended to be a time where what was always characteristic of convict Australia, a level of informality, became even more the case. People, I think, were just rejoicing in the common situation that they were a part of rather than seeking to retreat to their corners.
There was a love of imparting Christianity onto Indigenous cultures. Did that come through with Christmas as well?
That's true, but I think one of the really striking things, again, about the change over time is that Christmas really, through the 19th century, was essentially it's a pagan festival in its origins. It's a midwinter festival. And what you see coming out of Europe is it marks the deepest, darkest time of the year. So it's cold, it's dark, it's about transition, it's looking for signs of renewal, light and spring. One of the characteristics of a European Christmas was that you would always find anything that was green, mistletoe, anything that you could bring into the house and adorn the house to kind of say, well, spring is coming. So as strong as Christmas might be with its religious overtones, it always had that sense of being the deepest, darkest time of year where you're looking forward to renewal. And what's striking in Australia is, of course, that gets completely turned around because it's high summer, but you still have that desire to celebrate the season. So what Australians would often do at Christmas time was go out into the bush and find anything that they could that was flowering. This is why, you know, the Sydney Christmas bush is so important. It's a bush that flowers red at that time, and people would cut it down and bring it into the settlements in great numbers and hang it over their doors. So what you get is not so much the Christian elements as we now associate them with Christmas, but that desire to celebrate the season. And whereas in Europe they're celebrating midwinter, in Australia, cutting down trees, bringing them into the houses and so on, you see a celebration of high summer.
So we don't have a pine tree, we don't have mistletoe, but we'll use whatever we can find that resembles it.
Exactly. And I think one of the other interesting thing is the Christmas tree is only a fairly recent invention. I think people have dated the first Christmas tree to be popularised in Britain was in 1848 when Prince Alfred, who was German by birth, Queen Victoria's husband, started instituting in the palace at Windsor a Christmas tree. And that was a comparatively new thing at the time, to bring a tree, a pine tree, into a house. It's a German custom. It wasn't a British custom until Prince Alfred started saying, well, this is what we do in a sense where I come from. Interestingly enough, the German communities in South Australia were already starting to use Christmas trees, but in churches. They didn't have them in houses, they had them in churches. And again, part of the power of the Christmas tree is, as much as it's about, you know, a Christmas story, it's also about, you know, the one green thing that you have at the deepest, darkest time of the year.
Give it, so, go on.
No, well, I was really only just building on that to say that so much of what we associate as the symbols of Christmas are a product of the end of the second half of the 19th century. We really only start seeing Christmas cards around the 1870s onwards, partly because it's when postal services become more efficient and more economical. But I think one of my favourite images of Christmas cards are taken up very quickly in Australia, but they're also Australianised very quickly. From the 1870s onwards, you get Australian Christmas cards with Santa being drawn by kangaroos. You get bush scenes, you get native wildflowers rather than sort of mistletoe and holly and so on. There's a remarkable Australianising of Christmas right from the start.
The other thing that you associate with Australia is immigration and the importance of immigration,
yes,
to the communities. If that's the case, did we start to see Christmas, the recognition of Christmas in Italy, in China, in Afghanistan, because we had Afghan people coming out here from a long time ago.
That's right.
And those influences coming into Australia as well, and the Dutch?
You do, and I think you see that in the food, and you certainly see that in the rituals of observance. And again, it's a characteristic of Southern European Christmases that, keep making this point about pagan elements, but I remember my family lived for a brief period of time in Italy and brought back some really, for me as a child, quite haunting Italian Christmas figures, including witches and elves and those kinds of, you know, the dark side, the creatures of the forest side of Christmas. So the Southern European side of Christmas, I think, was very strong. And I think you're right, there were those ethnic differences that got folded into the different kinds of foods that were eaten. Mm. And to some extent, I think an Australian Christmas in the 19th century was, if I can put it kind of, might sound anachronistic, but more multicultural than it was in the first part of the 20th century, just in terms of what people were eating. If I can just, I've got a really, what seems to me a really revealing passage from a Melbourne journal of 1865. Do you mind if I read you a bit?
No, please.
So this is the Illustrated Melbourne Post of 1865, and I think this is a really interesting reflection on how Christmas in Australia was different from very early on. And here it goes. There is also far less chance of sadness invading us, that is Australia, on an Australian than a European Christmas. For the general plunge into boisterous holiday-making in the open air relieves us of the possible sadness which may sometimes intrude into the family circle on a Christmas day in snow-clad lands. There, the thought being necessarily concentrated on their narrow circle and the circumstances which have brought them together, there is a tendency to count heads and to mourn over the absence of some beloved one. In the Australian Christmas, the boundless exuberance of nature, as we penetrate her loveliest haunts, precludes the possibility of much sadness, and naught but one harmonious note of joy is heard over hill and dale. And I think that says a huge amount about the different resonances of Christmas in Australia. And you often see that reflected, that it's not that European sense of small families getting together, you know, in the dark. But it's that sense of let's go outside, let's kind of be part of a community, let's rejoice in that informality that you mentioned right from the start, going right back to the convicts.
I've got a couple of texts here. I remember getting a GT foam surfboard for Christmas when I was a kid in the 70s, when I was a kid in Scarborough in the 60s and 70s, where there's a hot, it was hot at Christmas. Our presents always included bathers, a beach towel, and other beachy stuff, and then we'd have lunch at the beach to try out our presents, which really just expands from what you're saying there in that it was a time that everybody had a great time. It was fun. It wasn't about staying inside and being stuck in there in front of a fire.
Absolutely. And again, that's a really distinctive thing about the Australian Christmas. It's because of the inversion of the seasons. But it's always a time for outdoors. It's always a time for relaxation and recreation. And Boxing Day, really, from the second half of the 19th century onwards, always was associated with sport, excitement, races, cricket. It was the time, in a sense, that the day after Christmas, when people just, you know, as your listeners have said, you know, got their presents and went out of the bush with bathers, cricket bats, or whatever.
Nick,
so in Australia, it's always been associated with activity, the outdoors, picnics, and so on.
Nicholas, isn't it incredible though that the traditional Christmas lunch is something that stayed over a long period of time?
Well, that's true. But it's also the case that, again, if you go back into the 19th century, what Australians are eating then is not always the traditional Christmas meal. Again, there's a level of adaptation. If you can't get a chicken, you get a parrot. If you can't get a goose, you get a swan. But people are also you often see in recipe books of the 1860s, 1870s, people saying, don't cook yourself a hot meal. It's far too hot. Have something cold, cold meats and so on. Even Henry Lawson has a poem where he recounts a family sitting around and having what he calls a sensible Australian dinner, which he says is everything cold. And I think this is fascinating. Everything cold except the vegetables. So that sounds horrible to me. But he also, again, this is a Henry Lawson poem. He refers to an Australian Christmas, when you have a sensible Australian Christmas dinner, means that the women don't end up looking like boiled carrots and feeling like boiled rags. So, yeah, there is that sense.
Because it doesn't heat the house up. You haven't got the hot stove and it doesn't heat the house up. There are all sorts of reasons not to have the stove going on Christmas Day.
All sorts of reasons. So, you know, I think we go through the ritual every year of will we or will we not have a hot Christmas lunch. The striking thing is, if you go back through Australian history, people were not having hot Christmas lunches. They were having picnics.
Let's take a look at the First World War and the significant impact that had on Christmas in Australia.
Well, again, I think if there is a tone of sadness that excerpt that I read out a little while ago brings out in relation to Christmas, you did see it then. I mean, what the First and the Second World War tended to do was to accentuate absence. You know, there were people who were not here. But still, and what Christmas also started to happen, also began to be associated more with then, was concepts of loyalty, duty, celebrating not just the family Christmas, but the national Christmas. So certainly the ways in which Christmas were associated during warfare did change. They became much more concentrated on, honour and celebrating the things that brought the nation together rather than just the family together. And inevitably, they highlighted a sense of loss. But huge ingenuity as well. I mean, families put together food parcels to send over to sons who were serving overseas. Places were often set at tables for sons who were not there, or fathers or husbands who were not there. What you often see with Christmas is that sense of adaptability to circumstances. But what often stays at the core of the Australian Christmas is that notion of family.
One of the things, and as well as that, there is a lack of money, and as well, when you take a look at the Great Depression in Australia, there's a lack of money, and I wonder whether or not we started to go back to the first settlers and just cope with Christmas in the best way you possibly could.
Exactly, and I think some of the most poignant things, I partly work at the National Museum of Australia in Canberra, and one of the most poignant things you have there are the kind of toys that people would make with very limited resources, a butter box or whatever, to give their children over Christmas. And again, it's that kind of ingenuity. We don't have much, but what can we do with what we've got? So there is that attempt to create the one toy or the one gift or the one way of celebrating the season. But again, to make the basic point, I suppose I've been making often. I mean, with what you see often associated with Christmas is, even if it's simply bringing in the mistletoe, even if it's simply getting some flowers or cutting down a tree, it's not all. It's only really, again, through the 20th century that Christmas becomes the kind of commercialised phenomenon that we now associate with it. Christmas gifts were not traditionally opulent, they were not traditionally extravagant, they were simple acknowledgements of the season. But if I can just, I'm sorry, I'm being a real academic here.
Oh, no, we like that.
I've got another passage that I really like, and it partly relates to your point about making do with what you've got and the impact of poverty and the depression and so on in Australia, because one of the things that was marked even in the 19th century was that Australians were relatively prosperous. I mean, towards the end of the 19th century, in terms of income, we're the richest country in the world. So people are starting to observe that what Australians do at Christmas is partly celebrating their wealth, their comparative wealth. So, here is, again, it's a contrast between how Christmas might be celebrated in winter in England and how it's celebrated in Australia. On the contrary, here again, this is a passage from 1864. Mm. There is a thoroughly festive character about all such celebrations of Christmas in Australia, which is the exception instead of the rule in England. There, in England, if an artisan and his family surrender a day or two to relaxation and conviviality, the respite for labour has to be preceded by weeks of economy and probably followed by the exercise of self-denial, and the present enjoyment is clouded both by the retrospect and the forecast. No such anxious consideration impair the artisan's sense of enjoyment of Christmas in Australia. He is prosperous and all his prospects are encouraging. His independence and his social and political status tend to impart a feeling of heartiness to his hours of diversion, while they communicate a sort of rough manliness to his general demeanour. A Christmas dinner in Australia necessarily takes the shape of an al fresco meal. It is eaten under green boughs, like the Feast of Tabernacles amongst the ancient Israelites. And I'll go on, I won't go on. Hmm. But again, I think you've got there the sense that what people are celebrating in Australia is summer, it's leisure, it's relative prosperity. And again, it's not that sense that Christmas often had in Europe about melancholy.
When did we start to see that opulence come through in the way that we celebrate Christmas? I'm thinking about in some areas with the gold rush when there was money around. And then was it later in the 60s?
Yep. I think it really is a product of the end, the second half of the 19th century. It's a product. It's a product also, let's be frank, about commercialization. It's a product that, people are starting to sell things specifically for Christmas. Department stores are starting to run Christmas lines. So it's to a large extent a product of commercialization. The Christmas card is fundamentally a product of commercialization.
A lovely text here from Deb saying, stone fruits were expensive and rare, so at Christmas time you got a piece of plum, peach or orange cherries, etc., in a pillowcase.
Yeah, exactly.
They were considered to be treats.
Yes. And I think that's true. A lot of the things that we now associate as necessarily being part of Christmas, they were not always. You work with what you had.
Can I give you
another? This will be the end of one of my passages, but I really like this from Henry Lawson. Mm. Do you mind?
No, of course not.
It's a Henry Lawson poem from about 1903. Then Jim comes home from shearing, and he puts a few away with Dad, perhaps, or Uncle, but they're right on Christmas Day. For be out on the Never Never or neath the church bell's chime, the family gets together, if they can, at Christmas time. Now, I think that catches quite a lot. When Jim comes home from shearing, and he puts a few away, but that notion that the family gets together if they can at Christmas time, there's always that slight sense. And I must admit, I think we're becoming increasingly conscious of it, and we should, that not everybody has equal access to the standard stereotypical image of an opulent Christmas.
No, and there are plenty of people that today won't be able to spend Christmas with family.
Exactly.
Because of work, because of all sorts. They may work overseas, they may work interstate, they may not be able to do it for financial reasons, which is very similar to back then.
And I think one of the great factors I'm certainly noticing amongst my friends is divided families. Divided families because your children live in different cities, or divided families because of separation.
Yep.
And I think we've still, medical practitioners will say, it's Christmas that brings out the most heightened levels of anxiety and unhappiness and just depression, because we're all measuring ourselves against that kind of ideal of the nuclear family exchanging really expensive presents around a table. The basic point, I suppose, we're talking about here is that was not always the case. The great message, I think, of an Australian Christmas, and perhaps of Christmas as a season everywhere, has always been one of adaptability and making the most of what you've got. The family gets together, if they can, at Christmas time.
Tim, good morning.
But like you say, just on the last fellow's previous comment on adaptability, it sort of harks back to me to what my dad used to do with, you know, the whole Santa Claus thing and putting the beer and the nuts under the chimney. But he also used to walk out and put a crate of beer for the milkman and the garbo. And I've done that tonight, and I'd just like to suggest that it's those little things that, you know, these services that we pay for in rates and whatnot, but, you know, there are people out there, that are faceless people, I suppose, that really contribute to our lives.
Yeah, and look, Tim, before that it was the night cart guy.
Well, that's basically where the bin is.
But that tradition is a beauty. I don't know if it's only Australian, Nicholas, but it's one of those traditions that has gone down through time.
Exactly, but I think your caller's right. I think I remember as a child you'd put a bottle of beer out by the garbage bin and you'd kind of be confident that it was going to be there when the garbage man came to collect it. I don't think, A, we put the bottle out by the garbage bin anymore, and B, I don't think we're confident it would be there when the garbage man came to collect it. I think you're right. There are those kinds of traditions of sharing, but I think we've become a little bit more insular in the way in which we do that now. We don't actually extend that much generosity to others. It's become very much our family Christmas. I'm struck when you look at television programs now about, you know, the endless series of celebrity chefs telling you how to prepare a meal for your family. It's very rarely about the celebration of Christmas in the larger context.
Did it used to be more of a community recognition and not family one, Nicholas?
I think it did, only because, again, it partly goes back to the habit of al fresco picnics, that people would gather together rather than stay inside, that Boxing Day certainly was always associated with organised sporting activities. It's not until 1945 that you get the Sydney Hobart Yacht Race starting on Boxing Day. But that, in a sense, proved the pattern, that it was always a time, traditionally, where people would get out together rather than necessarily just stay at home amongst a closed circle.
Jackie, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you going?
Good.
I was just listening and thinking about my first Australian Christmas, because I came from England. We migrated here in the 50s. A very different sort of a Christmas, because we were in the migrant hostel in Nunawading. We shared that hostel with Italian families, German families, the Islander families. And Christmas lunch involved going to our canteen, a big, large Nissen hut, with all the different nationalities there, where the food was all prepared by the hostel people. It was interesting to see the different decorations and things that the people had brought onto their own tables. And we did carolling on the Christmas Eve.
How many nationalities were there, Jackie?
Oh, stacks. There were so many. Polish people, there were Italians, a lot of Italians, mainly British, but there were all different groups.
And it was, what were the presents? Were there presents?
We all got presents. Each family had their own hut, you know, half a hut, and everybody had their own different style of Christmas. But at lunchtime, dinner was served at midday, and that's where everybody congregated into the canteen.
So were they presents that people managed to make and put together from what they had?
Quite often, there were lots of wooden toys. A lot of the people on the hostel were very generous in that they would give the kids. I received presents from neighbours around, little wooden toys that had been made, or little rag dolls and things like that.
Now, it was a tough time for many people, Jackie, when they were living in those missing huts, and because you hear many stories that were tragic. But around Christmas time, did people manage to make it happy?
We were very happy in that area. We were looking forward. We had we were starting a new life, and I think our group you know, the people that stayed that I know of were happy people. Some British people went home because they just couldn't handle Australia. But the majority of people were saying, we've come here to start a new life. And they were, you know, they would move out and go into different houses.
Hmm.
But very, very happy. And, everybody made do with what we had because it was a bit cramped and things. But I think everyone was happy in what they had.
And a very communal Christmas.
Very, very communal Christmas.
Good on you. Thanks, Jackie.
No way.
That's an interesting reflection on a time for a lot of people coming out here and the different ways that people recognise Christmas coming together, Nicholas.
I think it's a great story, and I think there are a couple of really powerful elements of it. Firstly, that even though there are some cultural differences in the ways in which Christmas is celebrated, nonetheless, it's kind of the one day of the year, certainly in the Christian calendar, that kind of draws people together. So there is that sense of that fundamental sharing. There is that sense of adaptability. I think your caller also made the very powerful point that, you know, so far we've been talking about an Australian Christmas as a time of kind of communal getting together. But for many immigrant people, it is also a time of kind of sadness to the extent that they are conscious of having left. You know, there are people on the other side of the world. And I think sometimes we have been over-nationalistic, I think, in claiming an Australian Christmas, a distinctive Christmas, which is all about what we kind of archetyped do, rather than reflecting on the real diversity and often the real sense of absence or loss or relocation that characterises the Christmases of, you know, to use an old phrase, new Australians. Mm. And I live in a part of Canberra which is characterised by a lot of Italian, Greek, Polish immigration, particularly people who came out to work for the Snowy Mountains scheme. And if you hear the ways in which, again, it's a little bit like that caller, Christmases were celebrated in the huts of the Snowy Mountains scheme, where you've got people from Scandinavia and Germany and Poland, Italy and so on, there is a remarkable coming together of different kinds of cultures to celebrate that kind of one essential festival. And I think that's an element that we could reflect on a little bit more, the inherent cultural diversity rather than the sameness, the tinsel and the holly of Christmas.
Jenny, good morning.
Hi. As a child in the 60s, I came from a big family and we didn't really have much. And so Christmas was such a special time. Everybody got something for Christmas and it was just so good. And weeks before, we would make things like for the Christmas tree and decorations. But these days, I think it's been stolen from the children because with the Olympics, they've changed the timetable so that Christmas starts like 2 days or something. But they don't finish school before 2 days before Christmas. And I think it's changed the whole atmosphere, you know what I mean? Because we had so much time before Christmas, you know, 2 or 3 weeks before actually, you know, Christmas Day. And I think the children really miss out because it's sort of so rushed, you know what I mean?
Oh, so what you're saying is that
it's rushed.
Because it depends on what school they go to, though. But so there isn't the lead-up to Christmas that there used to be for some schools.
Well, it used to be 2 weeks before Christmas. But
yeah,
now
it's not anymore.
It's only 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, like the children, like this, it's only, I think it was this 2 days ago or something, they sort of left. But, and that was all because of the Olympics. They changed the whole system so that they could fit it in. And I think they should really think about going back to, you know, having more time before Christmas and not so much after.
Jenny, that just brings up the whole idea of holiday periods and around Christmas. Did we always, Nicholas, have the Christmas holidays?
Christmas Day was always traditionally recognised as a holiday. Boxing Day became a kind of a standard holiday in the 1860s, I think. And that steadily you got that notion that people would not, you know, that many people would take the period between Christmas and New Year as a holiday. But I think, again, that call has made an interesting point. I was fortunate enough to live for 2 years in Ireland. And again, I think we often lose sight of the fact that our sense of Christmas as a holiday is very much associated because it comes in our summer. And that's when, you know, we have school breaks. But in Ireland, I was teaching at University College Dublin. We taught until Christmas Eve, and those kids were back in school on the 2nd of January, back at lectures on the 2nd of January. So it's really our sense of the long Christmas holiday is because it's summer. in Europe, it's Christmas is punctuated in the middle of a winter series in which the last thing, in a sense, you want to do is sit at home doing nothing.
And the same in America.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in a sense, Thanksgiving, I think, interestingly, has more power as a holiday to some extent than Christmas itself does.
Was there? I don't know if you know this or not. Was there always a lengthy Christmas holidays for schools?
Yes, there was, but only in Australia because it's summer.
We tend not to
ask kids to go to school in high summer, and it partly goes back to that earlier caller. I mean, it's a time that kids are given toys that they or surfboards and so on that they will use for their summer holidays. It's different in Europe because you're not giving children things that they will use through their outdoor-oriented holidays. You're probably giving them things that if they're going to play with, they're going to play with inside.
Nicholas,
it's a fundamental thing, but I think it's just a really interesting way to reflect on how that summer-winter polarity shapes so many aspects of what traditionally we've done for Christmas. But if I could just give you one last... I said this a minute ago. But it partly goes back to your earlier caller's sense about making do and the focus on children. What little Christmas used to be associated with. And here's a passage from the 1850s. One of the principal features of Christmas in Australia is the gay array of bushes that deck the veranda posts of the houses. In towns, men go round with dray loads of green bushes, selling them for sixpence or a shilling a bundle. But outside, they're cut and dragged home by the children. A big armful is lashed to each post till the veranda is hidden behind a wall of greenery. Even a selector's hut standing alone in a wilderness of trees is annually decorated in this way. And often, all that people... If it was all that they could afford, if it was all that they could manage, how people would celebrate Christmas was with that sense of bringing in greenery. It doesn't need to be hundreds of presents under the tree. It can be that marking of the seasons.
I've got a lovely text here saying that they're enjoying the readings. Where can people get hold of the readings that you're doing?
Oh, God, I can't remember where I've got them all from, but I'll see if I can find out and I'll send you a text and let you know.
That'd be lucky, and that'd be lovely. And we'll put them on our website probably as well. We've gone up to this. How did Christmas really change from the 60s through to what we have now?
Oh, look, I think, I don't want to be kind of boring about it, but I think it's essentially commercialization. I think it's essentially it becomes highly profitable for businesses. I'm not criticizing the big department stores, but from early 1950s, Meyer, David Jones start putting up their Christmas displays, their lights and so on. It becomes... We have expectations of lots of presents. It becomes built into the kind of holiday cycle. It becomes something that's much more associated with entertainment, with kind of Christmas concerts or carols at candlelight, which are often raising funds for charity and so on. But certainly when I was a child, you tended not to have that highly formalised way of celebrating Christmas. You tended to have much less informal ways, much less commercialised ways.
But you can even see the changes in carols by candlelight when you're watching it. Well, number one, it wasn't telecast, and number two, now that it is, you even see the difference in the last 4 or 5 years in that they're increasingly a show to highlight the particular television station that's broadcasting it, and you don't seem to see many people singing carols. It's more people on stage doing an act.
Well, exactly, and you want to listen to the celebrity singing the carols rather than sing the carols yourself.
Yeah.
And look, I'm sure you've got listeners old enough to remember the Christmas carol, Carol of the Birds, which was written in the 1920s. Out on the plains, the broggers are dancing, lifting their feet like war horses prancing. Up to the sun, the woodlarks go winging, faint in the dawn light, echoes are singing, Arana, Arana, Arana to Christmas Day. Now, when did you last hear an Australian Christmas carol sung?
Thank goodness you just did it for us, although we have played it not long ago. Actually, somebody mentioned it the other day, but it's true. We don't recognise our Australian Christmases perhaps enough in that you don't have to make it parochial, but you can recognise it.
Well, and I think, just as I was reading that, I was thinking, this is a bit naff, and, Arana is supposed to... I'm just looking at the photocopy I've got here, Arana is said to be an Aboriginal word meaning welcome. Well, we're all now too clever to talk about an Aboriginal word, and it's highly likely that Arana is highly manufactured to sort of give a bit of an Indigenous flavour to Christmas. But nonetheless, that was an attempt in the 1920s to say, if we're going to have Christmas, let's have it with an Australian character. Let's draw out a sense of the Australian environment. And I think we've lost a lot of that.
Nicholas, it's been a pleasure talking to you this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Happy Christmas.
And to you too. Dr. Nicholas Brown, Senior Research Fellow at the School of History at the ANU. You're listening to Overnights, and it's time for the news.